we're going to look at the population of the school as opposed to maybe the population growth of the city. We want to know what the population growth of the school is, how healthy it is, and are they increasing the population?
Welcome to Target Market Insights, a podcast to help real estate investors navigate neighborhoods through the lens of local experts. Each week, we speak with local specialists to talk about their target market, useful tips, and the latest trends and developments. Location is the number one rule of real estate, and this show will help you identify best markets and submarkets for your investing. This is Target Market Insights with your host, John Kasman.
Welcome to Target Market Insights. I'm your host, John Kasman, and today we're going to be talking to a student housing expert who's based in Southern California. Jeff Greenberg has over 50 years experience working with government agencies as well as private and public organizations. Since 2007, Jeff has been investing in multifamily and student housing assets in emerging markets. Jeff is the CEO of and managing member of Synergetic Investment Group. And SIG handles all aspects of projects, including acquisitions, operations, value adds, dispositions, and investor relations. Jeff has been involved in projects worth over $30 million, consisting of over 800 units, and they currently hold 318 student housing beds and properties in Georgia, Arizona, and Ohio. Let's welcome to Target Market Insights, Jeff Greenberg.
Well, thank you very much, John. Thanks for having me.
Jeff, thanks for coming on. So first of all, I'm going to assume this must be a typo in your bio because it says over 50 years experience working with government agencies. Is that real?
Yeah, I've been working for government agencies all my life.
Well, did you start when you were four?
the earlier part of my life.
Got it. Well, you certainly don't strike me as somebody who's been doing this that long. So I wasn't sure if that was completely accurate or not.
Yeah. I think I first got my first job with the city government when I was 15 years old.
Wow. Wow. Awesome. All right. So you were doing that. And then obviously now you're doing more in the multifamily student housing space. And that goes back to 2007. Start by just kind of walk me from how you went from working with government agencies to starting to invest in real estate.
Well, as far as the government and private agencies, I mean, I worked for city agencies, county agencies, as well as private companies such as private schools that I worked for many years. Went into the tech industry and actually was working in the IT department for, I believe, I was there for about 20 years there. And just kind of one day took a look at what was going on, like a lot of other people, saw that I wasn't going to have sufficient income for my retirement, and kind of woke up, you know, rich dad, poor dad kind of helped out with that and started looking at real estate.
All right. So this is around 2007?
Yeah, it was, which is not, it was not a good time to really be getting into real estate.
You're right, right. So around this time, you start looking at your 401k plans, realizing that you're not going to have enough there to sustain you, looking into real estate. What drove you to multifamily?
I liked the extra zeros on the numbers, but I also liked the fact that I didn't have to rely on the money that I had saved up, that I could use other people's money to help along the way, that I could help other people get good returns on their money while we were able to get into these larger deals. And then I would benefit from helping and servicing those projects.
So for those who aren't as familiar with that notion of using other people's money, or we'll call it syndication deals, can you just explain a little bit of how that works?
Well, fairly simple as far as the structure of it. I mean, essentially we're getting people together that are interested in getting good returns on their money. We bring them into deals. We do this under the guidelines of the SEC. We want to make sure that we have everything done properly. And we do that. What we do is we call it a private placement, or people typically know it as a syndication. And by bringing everybody together as far as the equity side of it, then we typically will get property leverage to bring in a loan as well. And basically, we are the general partner on the deal. We keep track of it all the way through disposition. And the equity partners essentially come in as passive investors. And we kind of run the entire project that way.
There you go. So basically, you guys, meaning your team, your company, you are the general partners. You put the deal together through this private placement or syndication. You at that point then go out, get a loan for the asset. And then as you hold that asset, you split the equity between your team, your general partners, and then the equity partners who are limited partners.
That is correct.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. So how did, I mean, so that seems like for some folks, it might be a challenging thing to start with. Is that how you started by syndicating deals, or did you start with kind of your own portfolio first?
I started syndicating deals. The first apartment that we purchased was a syndicated deal. It was a small one, 20 unit property, but it was syndicated. We did raise funds from investors for that property.
So walk me through that deal real quick.
Well, that was in 2010, actually. It was in South Texas. It was actually 5 fourplexes. I believe we bought it for $1,080,000, something like that. And we had to raise $350,000. Neither one of us, my partner nor myself, had ever raised funds in our lives. And we just raised it from people we had met along the way. She got in a lot of people that she had worked with, previous employers that had known her. But for the most part, it was people that I had met after I got into real estate that, you know, trusted me. So we got into that one about $350,000 and held that one for about 6 years. That was an excellent learning property.
So what tips would you give for somebody who's looking at maybe their first syndication and maybe a deal similar, right? So around 20 units or so, and you live in California, so this deal been in South Texas. Walk us through maybe your key learning that you'd want someone else listening to this to take away.
Make sure you have some value add in there. That was the learning process we had on this one. This was a 2007 build. We bought in 2010. It was 100% occupied. There was not a lot of value add. It was in a very slow growth community. So I would say definitely you want to look at your market. You want to look at your value adds. It was a great learning process. The investors did okay. We barely made any money, but it was a great learning process. So my suggestion to anybody new is make sure the project can actually handle getting investors' returns and yourself getting returns. So in a market is critical as far as what's going on in the market, if you're going to be able to raise rents or not. That was something that we did not realize, that we weren't going to be able to get the rent increases that we expected. And it was a long process where we learned a lot.
So what was your due diligence process with that as far as rent growth and those opportunities? And what did you see there that maybe you missed when you actually owned the property and were actually executing?
Well, there wasn't a lot of comps for us it was a small market. So, you know, we went on the assumption that we could grow rents. One thing is the city government at the time was very slow growth oriented, but a new government structure had taken over and they encouraged us that they were pushing for a lot better growth in the community, mainly because they saw other communities close by that were much better off economically because they were allowing in new businesses, because they were encouraging growth. And this particular city had just allowed Bass Pro Shop to come in, and they were supporting most of the construction of Bass Pro Shop because they thought it was going to bring in a lot of other businesses into the community. And so that was very encouraging to us. So that kind of led us to believe that rents were going to increase. The property was also just right down the street from a hospital. There was a lot of new construction in the area. So we felt that the rents could be increased a lot faster than they ended up actually happening.
Got it.
But we did, you know, we talked to the city. We went all around and did a lot of our due diligence, you know, with the city agencies and stuff. And everything was encouraging, but still, it was a small community. The growth wasn't going to happen very quickly. And the only other value add we had was billing back on water. They were already paying their own electricity. And that met with quite a bit of resistance. We did have a difficult time trying to bill back on water. So, and we, at that time, we really didn't know that much about value adds. It was all new to us. It was our first syndication. And certainly, I would look a lot closer at those issues in getting into a market again.
No, that makes sense. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think now you're focused on value add. We focus on value add, and it's that reason you mentioned, right? I mean, when you're dealing with a property that was built 3 years prior, I mean, that's great when you think of, oh, it should have, you know, low expenses and should be less repairs. The challenge, though, is that there's probably not a whole lot of room to make improvements and to really drive or control the value and the growth and drive that rental income growth. So it does kind of limit you a little bit, but value add is certainly a reason we play in that spaces for the reasons you just gave. And I know that you've obviously implemented that into your business plan going forward. I love the couple points, though, when you talk about the market in South Texas and it being a smaller market, the fact that you were talking to the local government and understanding what their ambitions were, what were they looking to do, that they were very supportive of growth and trying to find ways to support that, that they were supporting this Bass Pro Shop, which obviously is going to bring jobs and people into that community, into that environment, maybe folks who don't live in the area or maybe just, you know, driving nearby. So that's a great thing as far as looking at the growth. And it sounds like overall that did happen. It just happened slowly. Is that right?
Yeah. And the other thing is that we were hoping on, which did happen actually, is the SpaceX is actually, the launch site is actually being built not that far from the property. And they were supposed to start some launches, and that's all been slowed down. So they were supposed to get their first launches in 2017, and now it's 2018, and I don't know when they're going to actually get manned launches, because that's going to bring a lot of traffic through the area, and that should help the community. But it's, you know, we couldn't be waiting for it. You know, maybe 2019, something will happen down there.
Do you still own that property?
No, we sold it last year.
Okay, great. So you went full cycle on that one.
We went 6 years on a 5-year hold on that one.
Got it. So for those people who are not as familiar with going full cycle, and you talked about holding it a 6-year when you were expected a 5-year hold, why did you hold it that extra year?
Because we decided on a price that we would accept, and we started in year 4.5. And it wasn't until year 6 that we finally got it. We felt that was going to be the minimum return that we wanted to get for our investors. And so we actually extended our loan, because the sale, the closing was going to cost us a lot of the profit or a lot of the equity that we had built up over the years. And so we drew a line in the sand and said this was the price we were going to get. And it took us that long before we finally got it, and we're able to give a decent return for our investors.
Makes sense. So let's fast forward now. So you have that one as your starter, your first syndication deal. You've got 318 units now. At what point did you start transitioning into more of the student housing?
Well, we went from that one. We bought a property in Houston, which is a C property, which we also sold last year. Then we also got this opportunity up in Oxford, Ohio, that was the first entry into student housing. I had an intern working for me, and he found the property, and it was a good opportunity. The numbers worked. It had some value add, but we were getting it pretty significantly under market, and so that presented an opportunity for us.
So Oxford, Ohio, obviously I'm from Ohio, OH, but that's very close to Miami University. So clearly, you know, that is an area where you got a strong university there. What's the difference? I mean, how do you evaluate that, this student housing multifamily opportunity versus a traditional multifamily opportunity?
Well, on the student housing, you're looking a lot at the strength of the university, where typically your multifamily, you're looking at the strength of the rest of the market. But the thing is, somewhere like Oxford, Ohio, that you may be familiar with, that community is basically almost all students in the market. And typically in a normal multifamily market, we don't like markets that are pretty much reliant on one resource as far of employment or of tenant source. And in the universities, a lot of times you do have that. But this is I believe it's a 200-year-old university. It's been around for a while. They're investing $40 million multi-year improvement plan on it. That, more than likely, that university is not going anywhere. But typically, when we're looking for multifamily, we wouldn't want to rely on a single source of income. So that's different. The other thing is we're going to look at the population of the school as opposed to maybe the population growth of the city. We want to know what the population growth of the school is, you know, how healthy it is, and are they increasing the population? We'd also be looking at what percentage of the school can they carry on site as far as the tenants. We don't want a school that has enough dorm rooms that they can handle all the kids. We want that to be under 30%, and the rest of the students going to have to be, you know, housed off-site. I also like, as far as with the Miami or the Oxford property, is it's 45 minutes away from Cincinnati and an hour away from Dayton. So there's nothing really close to it. Most of those kids are going to live in that city and are not going to be commuting. I wouldn't say that it's really a commuter campus as some others might be, where they could stay home with mom and dad.
No, those are great points. And that last one in particular, I mean, I went to what was considered a commuter school down in that area in Southwest Ohio. And that was one of the things that I noted was that a lot of the other students, they did commute. They lived home with mom and dad and they would come in for classes. They would drive back home. But in the areas where you're describing, I mean, if folks don't live in that area, most people are, you know, coming in specifically to go to that college and, you know, they have no choice but to live somewhere near campus. You mentioned that being 45 minutes away from Cincinnati, an hour away from Dayton, Ohio. Those are things that were enticing to you more because they were, I'm going to say, far away in the sense that they weren't that close. Whereas I think we typically look at it the other way, saying, okay, great, you know, there's major employment in some of these major metros or these hubs. So that's a good thing. So you're saying that those are actually things you look for to make sure that there's a far enough distance away that would deter someone from commuting.
Well, that's certainly a plus. We're certainly looking in other properties that may not have that, but that's just one of the criteria. I mean, it is nice, and that's one of the things I did like about this Oxford property, and that's what first got me into it, was that there's not too many people that want to drive in an Ohio winter to get to school, you know, driving for an hour or so in that winter.
Certainly not. And I unfortunately had to do it many times, so it's not fun. So let me recap for those who are listening, right? So you love the university, and you want to take a look at the university demographics. So where are they at? How long have they been in operation? Are they growing? Are they investing in upgrades? What's the plan look like for the foreseeable future at the university? Then you're looking at the population growth of that school and how many students are staying on campus. You're looking for 30% or less staying on campus, meaning that most of the students are looking for off-campus housing. Do you start looking at like how many other apartments or complexes are around? Do you have any things you look for there?
Well, I want to see what the occupancy rate is of the property that we're looking at, as well as what's going on in the market as far as the occupancy rates. And one of the things at this particular university is any property that's within what they call the mile square is generally at 100% occupied. And those people that are farther out from the mile square generally have lower occupancy the farther that they are out. So that's another thing, is it's definitely location. As far as how close it is to the university is very important. And the other location thing is how close it is to the bar district. So that typically is a important thing as well. So if you're close to the university or close to the bar district, those definitely are pluses when you're looking at the student housing.
So I was looking at a property in the University of Cincinnati, I should say in Cincinnati, but it's close to the University of Cincinnati. And one of the things that I learned quickly was that there was a preference for essentially the location, meaning what street, like literally the street the property was on. And I think it had ties to what you just mentioned with the bar district. So whether it is, you know, the east side of campus, the west side of campus, the south side of campus, there was certainly a strong preference for, you know, one side of campus versus the other. And you would see that reflected in the rent numbers. How are you mining and going through all that data from afar, especially if you're in California? Are you flying in and kind of going through all this, talking to the locals, or how are you getting that level of detailed information?
Most of it initially is talking to the locals, and most of the time we're talking to property management companies. As we're interviewing the property management companies for possibly managing these properties, we're going to ask them about the property and how they feel about the property and what the competition is doing as well. So we do rely heavily on the property management companies and to get that information.
Got it. Makes sense. All right. So that's the Oxford, Ohio one. You still have that one under management?
Yes, we do. That one, we're coming on 3 years now on that one.
Okay. And is the plan to hold that one for a 5-year hold or what's the business
plan? Yeah, that one we've got a 5-year loan on. That was before we started looking at these longer loans. But yeah, we had a 5-year loan on that. So we'll probably hold that one for a 5-year period.
Excellent. All right. So you also are in Georgia and Arizona. So how did those acquisitions differ from this first one in Ohio?
Yeah, quite a bit different. Both the Arizona and the Georgia one we actually got last year. The Georgia one we got, it was actually a year ago, April, that we got this one. And this one is totally different. It broke a lot of rules, but it was a phenomenal opportunity. In that the market was a very, very small market. The university is a very small university. This one's a 36-unit, 144-bed property. It was at 48% occupied. Well, 60% occupied, 48% economic. It was foreclosed on. We actually bought it from a note holder. And so it was a non-performing note that they needed, that they wanted to move. And so we bought it from them. We bought it at a phenomenal price. We paid $1.1 million for it. It had been appraised a few years back for about $2.8 million. And so we got that. We've been working on it for a year and a half now. And in August, it's going to be at 100% with a waiting list. And I'm estimating conservatively that the property is going to be worth about $5
million. Wow. How much did you have to put into it?
We've put into it somewhere around $400,000.
Wow. So you're going to be all in around 1.5.
Yeah, exactly. My raise was 1.5. My raise was 1.5, and we expect it to appraise out at that. And we paid all cash for it, so we have no debt on it. But we'll finance that one probably after we season it a little bit on 100% occupied. We'll get it seasoned and then get it appraised and get everybody's money back on it.
That's awesome. So two questions and there's follow-ups. One, when you say you paid all cash and you're going to look to refinance after seasoning, will the investors still own their equity in the deal?
That's what the plan is. We could finance it, not exactly a refi since there's no fi on it, but we can finance it, get all their money back, give them cash flow on that. They would still have the ownership. We could also sell it, get everybody's money back, plus quite a bit of extra. But we're looking into it as far as what exactly we're going to do. It's also on 9 acres, which we can further develop. But with the cost of, I've been looking at cost of construction, and I'm not sure if that's going to, you know, get us what we want. But we do have another probably about at least 5 acres that we haven't used that we could develop, or maybe we'll sell those off. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is like that makes sense to maybe sell off some of that acreage. But
except I don't know if we want to create our own competition if somebody buys and builds on it.
Yeah, it kind of depends on your long-term strategy, right? So the other question was, you mentioned seasoning. What kind of seasoning do you need? And just explain that for those who may not be as familiar with that term.
Well, the main thing is if we wanted to get agency debt on it, they typically like 90% occupied for 90 days. So that's really what I'm talking about, is just getting it in there enough time occupied, fully occupied, for us to get a strong loan.
Yep. So the agency debt being the government-backed loans from Freddie and Fannie. So the last thing just on this point was you mentioned 36 units, 144 beds. When you're analyzing deals like this, do you focus primarily on the bed count because that's going to be essentially the number of students, or do you focus on the number of units more? Does it not matter?
Well, it's going to depend on how we're going to rent it up. And different markets typically do different things. My property in Ohio, they're all rented by the bed, but my property in Georgia and the property in Arizona are rented up. Excuse me, did I say bed? Ohio's by the unit and the other ones are by the bed. So I'm going to do my calculations based on how we're planning on renting it up. And that typically depends on the market. Now, some markets have both, where there's some doing it by the bed, and some doing it by the unit. Typically, you can make more money if you're doing it by the bed, but you have to have a property management company that's willing to do it by the bed and is able to handle that. And they, you know, willing to do roommate matching, trying to, you know, get people that are going to not kill each other. You know, it's sometimes hard when you have young people in there, if they're going to get along. But typically you want to know, put all the partiers together and all the people that want to go to sleep early, you know, put them in different units, that kind of stuff.
Yep. And to your point about getting a property manager that's comfortable doing that, I know when I was talking to the guys in Cincinnati, part of it was also that the lead time to get some of these off-market housing, especially if the market's pretty hot, was almost a year out. I mean, he basically was doing leases in July, and they basically had 2 months to live in the unit before they had to make a decision on whether or not they were going to renew for the following year. Are you seeing similar lead times, or what's kind of the lead time you're seeing as far as, you know, renewals and kind of making sure you understand what the tenant situation is heading into the next school year?
It's funny that each market is so totally different. The Ohio market or the Miami University market, we're already leasing up for the 2019-2020 school year. And we'll probably be completely leased up by March as far as for next year. The only straggler we may have is we do have some studio apartments. Those may be the last ones to lease up. The Tucson ones typically are a little bit later. And the Georgia ones, last year we had kids coming in August, even after school had started. And I don't know if it has anything to do with the socioeconomic levels of those different schools, that some places plan more, but certainly with Ohio, the Ohio property, we've got to be way out in front of it. And we're leasing up a year ahead of time.
Yeah. And yeah, maybe it's critical. The size too, right? Because I mean, obviously the bigger the school or the bigger the demand, the more, especially if the school has a long history. I mean, you probably have people telling you before you're even applying, hey, you want to live here, you want to live, you know, this side of town, or you want to find an apartment over here, versus if it's a smaller school or a newer school, maybe you just don't have that same kind of pent up demand because people have options.
Yeah, it's going to depend a lot. And it also depends on, you know, those that want to be the closest to school in the newest buildings. Those, they probably need to lease up very quickly. Typically, we are not the high-end provider because the properties may not be the newest. So we're maybe the middle of the road or some of the lower-end providers. And so sometimes it's a little bit later that they start filtering down to those properties. So you kind of need to know where you are in the scale of things as far as what other people are renting and where you fit in.
I love it. So give me the next big difference for someone who's been focused on multifamily or evaluating multifamily versus student housing. What's the big thing they need to know or be mindful of?
Well, I mean, all of us are looking at the elephant in the room, which is, you know, what's going to happen with our overall economy. Every time I go to a conference or every time I talk to people, they're always asking, you know, well, when are things going to correct? Things have been doing so well for so long. So we're always looking to make sure that we're being very conservative on our estimates, on our underwriting, and making sure that we have sufficient time in our debt to make sure that if it's not a good time in 5 years to sell, that we still have another 5 years, that hopefully things will correct in that time. So I think keeping your debt at a distance, as well as making sure you have sufficient funds, that if you're going to do a raise, to make sure you raise above and beyond what your plans are, and putting stress tests on your deals in case things don't quite go the way that you want them to, that at least, you know, in the worst case scenario, you're still paying the bills, that you're keeping the lights on, you're paying the bills, and don't have to feed the alligator and try to keep it alive.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, that's a big thing right now is obviously no matter where the market is making sure you can control the outcome. So you're not sitting in a situation where, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, your debt's due. The banks aren't, you know, rates have jumped way up and you can't really extend without taking a loss, or maybe it's even harder to get that loan. And now you're forced to sell. So, I mean, that's the thing that Jeff's talking about, is make sure we avoid is being in a position where if the market's not where we need it to be to sell and optimize our returns on this investment, to be in a position where if we're still cash flowing, hold on to the asset a little bit longer and then sell when it makes sense. Jeff, going back to the question though, multifamily versus student housing, what's the, outside of the financing piece of it, what's the big difference that someone needs to know, whether they're evaluating as a passive investor or as an active investor? What's the big thing they need to know that's different between student housing and multifamily?
Well, student housing is a lot more volatile in that each year you've got a large turnover. That's the big thing that we're always looking at. And that's also part of where we're seeing our value add, that you need to have property management that are familiar with student housing, that are willing to go the extra mile that it takes to do student housing. My marketing budget is way different in student housing than it normally would be for multifamily properties. So you spend a lot of time dealing with the marketing, getting the lease ups. Your expenses are going to be higher on, not because that they're doing so much damage, because you know they're typically paying for any damage that they do, but more just you have more turnover. But that's also, a lot of this is part of the advantage that we're finding, and partly why we're finding student housing right now, is because it has been done poorly. The one we got in Georgia, the guy didn't know student housing, got an inappropriate on-site manager in there that ran it into the ground. The one in Arizona, the company, the property management company, didn't know how to do student housing and was charging under market rents, couldn't get students in the door. So it's fluctuates more. It's more volatile than a more stable multifamily. So you've got more opportunity in there, but there's also more opportunity to make mistakes. And so, you know, there's both sides of that coin.
That makes sense. I mean, obviously there's more complexity there. There's more risk involved, but probably a little bit more upside based on that as well. So with that noted, and you talked about the students, I mean, most of these students probably don't have credit or have minimal credit history. How do you screen these residents to make sure you are, you know, putting the right people in that will kind of protect your asset over the course of the holding period?
Well, we do check for the criminal record. And if they don't have credit, if they're not credit worthy, they don't have jobs, you know, we'll put the parents need to co-sign on those loans or on those on those leases.
All right. So you'll get the parents to co-sign basically, and that kind of covers you there. Okay, cool, cool. All right. So Jeff, I want to move on to the bullseye round in just a minute. But before we do, I want to ask you one last question. As you look at kind of where you're going with student housing, we've talked a lot about, you know, growth, and we've talked about the importance of being near the campus and watching what the university is doing. Do you have any concerns with the state of student loans? And does that have anything to do with the way you evaluate these deals, whether it be people, you know, financing their room and board and maybe, you know, applying a portion of that? But is there any concern when it comes to student loans and kind of the student loan debt epidemic that's going on in the country right now?
That's definitely a concern, you know, but it's, we're kind of where we are is we're not sure what's going to be happening with that. I don't believe that in most of the higher end properties, that's going to be an issue. It could be more of an issue on some of the lower end universities. And it's definitely a concern, but as long as, you know, our worst case scenario is something that we can live with, you know, then we're fine with it. But definitely the economy, what's going on in, you know, throughout the nation is also of concern. We're always concerned with different aspects that can affect us.
And now it's time for the bullseye round.
All right, first question. Give me your best tip for winning in student housing.
You know, just good underwriting. We look at a lot of properties. We look at a lot of deals, and we do the underwriting regardless of what the seller is asking. So we lose a lot of deals, and we're persistent. We do have relationships with a lot of brokers, and so we work on getting these deals. As we get more and more student housing, then we get more and more deals brought to us. The brokers are willing to speak up for us when we get into best and final because they see our reputation, they talk about us, and that helps out.
How do you stay on top of market changes?
Well, you know, every market is different, but when we're looking at a market, we find out what's going on in the market. We, you know, talk to economic development. We do research on the specific market, on what's going on there. And, you know, and as I said, on the student housing, a lot of it is what's going on with the university. We'll get read the local news, you know, for those markets and those universities and see what's going on. If there's companies coming in or if there's improvements to the universities, we'll check on all that as far as what's going on locally.
Give me a daily habit that helps you stay focused on your goals.
Well, I write down my tasks for the next day. I use Evernote and I do write down what I need to accomplish in that particular day. I also rely pretty heavily on my calendar. One of the first things I do in the morning is get up and look at the calendar, see what my day is going to be like and plan for that. I also try to exercise as much as I can so I keep myself as sharp as I can. And that's kind of my daily routine.
Give me the best business book you've read in the last year. It could be business or real estate.
Probably the best book in the last year, and I listened to it. I have to say I didn't read it because it's a right. Monster book, is Ray Dalio's Principles. I thought that was a very interesting book, but it's a huge book, so you might want to get it on audio.
Yep, it's a good book. We've had that suggested a couple of times. I just started it, so I'll have to keep you posted on that one. All right, give me a digital or mobile resource you use for investing or your business.
Well, my team spends all their time on Slack. We have multiple channels that we use on Slack, and my team is constantly communicating with each other, which allows me to go in and watch what's going on and watch the communications so I don't have to be there live at the time that they're communicating. I could see what's going on between team members as far as if they have questions or not. So Slack would be a major one. And then the other one is Podio. We put all of our deals into Podio, which is an online database where if anybody has any questions about any particular deal that we're working on, all of our notes are in there so we can see what's going on. If we decide the property is dead, we put notes in there why it's dead, or if we ever want to relook at it again, and all that information is there. But those two online applications are priceless.
All right, Jeff, so next time we're in Southern California, give me the best place to grab a bite and join you.
Well, if you're in Southern California, you got to go to Tito's Tacos. Anybody that's from the West LA, Culver City area in California knows what Tito's Tacos is. And I still go by there anytime I'm in that neighborhood. I'm a little bit outside of LA now, but Tito's has the best tacos and the best shredded beef burritos I've ever had.
All right, well, check it out, Tito's Tacos. Jeff, what's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you?
They can get me at my website, which is synergeticig.com, synergeticig.com, or email me at jeff@synergeticig.com, same spelling. I'm typically on BiggerPockets all the time, so you can always get a hold of me there as well.
Excellent. So, Jeff, give me a project that you're working on that you're excited about.
Well, we've got two student housing properties that are currently under a signed LOI and we're going to contract on.
And congrats. Awesome.
These are very large properties. And then there's also another property that we're looking at in West Texas that we're in the best and final on. So hopefully that one's going to get to an LOI. These are fairly large projects. So I'm definitely excited about those coming up.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Jeff, we're excited about those as well. And those are student housing projects as well, correct?
Two of those. The two that are under LOI are student housing projects, one in West Texas and one in Kentucky.
Well, Jeff, this has been great, man. Definitely enjoy you coming on the show and talking to us a little bit about kind of your story and how you got into student housing and just the business model you've built out and been able to do this in multiple markets. I mean, you started in Ohio. As far as the student housing, you started in Ohio, went to Georgia and in Arizona. Now you're in West Texas, and I know you're talking about a couple other markets as well. So that's really exciting. And the fact that you can do this across multiple states, I think shows that you've obviously built up some business models that allow you to be effective across the country. So thanks again, man, for coming on and sharing some insights with us about how to do student housing and giving us some great takeaways. And we definitely wish you the best of luck on your upcoming deals. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much, John. This was great.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right. You have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Target Market Insights. Now, I know I got some great value out of today's guest, and I hope you did too. And if you did, I need you to do me one big favor. drop me a quick line and let us know, right? So you can shoot me an email, you can shoot me a text, you can, you know, tweet me, you can hit me on IG in the comments, you can slide it to the DMs, whatever. But if you go ahead and do that, you know, my information is there at Jay Kasman for Instagram, for Twitter. And then you can also reach out to my email, john@kasmancapital.com. So with that said, I need you to do the same thing for our guests. So our guests are dropping some great gems, some great knowledge. I need you to reach out and let them know that you appreciate the information that they're giving. So their information is always in our show notes. You can check them out there. One last thing, if there are guests that you would love for us to have on the show and talk to, let us know. Or if there are markets that you want us to talk about, send us a note. I mean, there are definitely some markets that we haven't hit yet, so we want to make sure we get some guests to provide some information and some knowledge of those markets soon. But by all means, if there are markets or there's something that you guys want to hear about, let us know. It kind of helps us make the show even better. If you have not yet, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. And make sure you don't miss an episode. So with that said, thank you again for listening, and we look forward to bringing you more great target market insights. Take care.